We're pleased to welcome back Michael Esslin, who will speak to us today a sermon titled, It's Magic. His sermon explores through personal reflections the tension between our rational self that yearns for answers and that spiritual self that can be moved by wonder. Michael Esslin is a Unitarian Universalist and a certified chaplain, chaplain for the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. At the first Spirituality and Medicine Conference for a UCLA interfaith group of community religious leaders that he hosted, Michael presented this sermon. He's been invited many times to speak to students at UCLA about his work as a chaplain on death and dying and the spiritual dimension of the cancer experience. He's a member of the UU Community Church of Santa Monica and has been a popular guest speaker there and at 25 UU congregations, including ours. Please welcome Michael Esslin.
Good morning, and thank you for the nice welcome. It's wonderful to be back here. I want to share with you just a very brief reading from, it's actually from a Broadway musical of The Color Purple, and the libretto is by Marcia Norman, based on the novel by Alice Walker. In this scene, when the incredibly abusive character, Mr. Seeley's husband, makes his redemptive reconciliation with her, after they've traveled a very long way on their own respective journeys, Mr. says, I feel like this the first time I ever live on the earth as a useful man. I see things, wonder about stuff. Seeley asks, what you wonder about? Why us black? Why us men and women? Why us here in the first place? And what do you think? Seeley asks. I think us here to wonder. And while us wonder about the big things, us learn the little ones kind of by accident. And the more us wonder, the more us love. I have a breast cancer patient, Julie, who lives life in a deep and reflective way. She's got this seemingly innate positive spirit and hopeful outlook. She describes herself as spiritual, not religious. She was telling me about her husband, whom she described as a good, solid, loving guy. And what matters most to him in life, I asked. Money, she said, a little too quickly, because with a flash of her eye, it was as if she wanted to take that back, thinking she had perhaps betrayed him in letting that slip out. It was important to her that I know what a good guy he was. Well, I said, it sounds like maybe he just doesn't get the magic in life. That's it exactly, she said. He doesn't get the magic. I think we both knew exactly what we were talking about, but would be hard-pressed to articulate it any more precisely than that. Two or three careers ago, I was a professional dancer, and one of my last jobs was touring the country in the spring and summer of 1979 with the late magician Doug Henning. Some of you might remember Doug. He was sort of the latter-day version of the vaudeville staple of magician, but shot through the lens of sugar-coated hippie culture, sequins, and rainbows. Doug was passionate about his work, and he saw his work through a spiritual lens. He was a devotee of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, a student of TM. And for Doug, the state of wonder was a sacred state. And he saw his work, though as fake as snake oil, as a portal into that sacred state. The experience of wonder was something genuine and authentic, for the audience anyway. My mom is 83 years old, and as the end of her life draws nearer, she finds herself wanting answers to all the big questions in life with greater urgency, all the whys with a capital W. Like Julie, she lives life in a deep and reflective way. On her 82nd birthday, she and I took a lovely walk on the bluffs overlooking the wetlands of Morro Bay, where she lives. And we were chatting and chewing on all of these big questions and of our desire to know answers. And it occurred to me, Mom, maybe in this lifetime, in this go-around, we can only be in the audience. Maybe there's a magician, and maybe there's not. And maybe it's magic, and maybe it's not. But for my mom, as it is for Julie and as it is for me, the experience of wonder and magic is something real. And maybe even it's enough. As you use, we put a lot of store in the rational mind, in concrete principles and deeds and thoughts, we don't seem to spend a lot of time focusing on the ineffable in life. Even though for many of us, I imagine that sense of magic and wonder animates much of our lives, whether we would choose to use that vocabulary or not. So what is it? I had a patient, Carlene, who took an art therapy class, and one day she was telling me that the facilitator of the class just gave a one-sentence directive: draw a map. So Carlene chose to draw a map of cancer. Over here's the land of diagnosis, over here's the land of chemotherapy, over here's the land of sadness. I love the idea of that, and it made me think, what might a map of magic look like? And I came up with three lands on my map. Now, this is deeply personal. It's not remotely scientific and anything but complete. But the more I think about it, it kind of works for me. And the three lands on my map are the land of synchronicity, the land of scale, and the land of vulnerability. Synchronicity. I have a colleague, Sharon, who for years has studied under a particular rabbi, who posits the idea that perhaps our whole lives, the purpose of our whole being, might just be fulfilled in 1 5-minute conversation, one chance encounter with a total stranger. At first, I categorically dismissed the idea because on one hand, it's so damn deflating. Given all the energy I expend on everything that I think is so important. But the more I reflect on the synchronicities in my own life and in the lives of the patients I've seen over the years, momentary synchronicities that are game changers, really, well, the idea gives me some pause. I cannot tell you how many patients tell me stories of how they were misdiagnosed elsewhere or told perhaps the only option was hospice, and somehow through the chance phone call from a friend of a friend or the email from my brother-in-law's uncle, they found themselves on their way to a new drug trial at UCLA or to a particular oncologist and the hope of more life. And they find it. A couple of years ago, I was in the infusion clinic and I introduced myself to Carl, who was a newly diagnosed lymphoma patient. He was there with his wife, Donna, and their granddaughter. The tension between the three of them was palpable. There was this long family history of betrayal and resentment and anger. Of the three, Donna seemed to be wound particularly tight. As a chaplain, it was hard to know where to put my attention because each one seemed isolated and trapped in his own suffering. And so I just did my best and I listened. And after about an hour, I said a prayer and I left. I never saw them again. They were from out of state. A year later, Donna called the center where I worked and asked that I call her back. To tell you the truth, I did not remember who she was. So I called her and she said, "I just want to thank you for changing our lives, Michael. You might have even saved them. Carl is doing just great. Our marriage has never been better, and I feel liberated from decades of resentment. And it all started that day we met you at the clinic and you said that beautiful prayer. I came so close that day to getting up out of that chair and walking out of that clinic and out of my life for good. I was ready to jump out of my skin. I sat and I prayed for someone to hear me, and 5 minutes later, you walked up." If I look back on my own life and the intersection between career number 2 in the design world and career number 3 in chaplaincy, it too would boil down to one chance 5-minute conversation. It was February of 1992. I was volunteering at Project Angel Food in Los Angeles, delivering home-cooked meals to homebound men and women with AIDS. Every day, the drivers, we would gather those who wanted to. We'd put our bags of food in the center of the circle. We'd take hands. We'd say a blessing over the food. And we'd read the names of the men who had died the night before. Every day, there were 6 names. And one day, a woman named Cassandra came into our circle looking for volunteers. She had a passion. She didn't believe so many men should be dying alone. In those days, so many men were coming out to their families. At the same time, they were telling them they would be dead soon. And they were dying alone. So she was looking for volunteers to be with our clients who were very near death, around the clock, in 2-hour shifts. So if you're willing to get up in the middle of the night and go to somebody's apartment and hold their hand for a couple hours, raise your hand. I had this horrible feeling and fear in my gut. Don't make me do this. Don't make me do this. I can't do this. But somehow, I raised my hand. and it changed my life. And it planted the seed that led to chaplaincy so many years later. Well, many years later, I was doing a GLIDE speaking engagement. I speak a lot about homophobia in the community. And I was speaking with Margot, who's one of our most gifted and prolific speakers. Now, I'd always known Margot to be an atheist. And one day during this engagement, she was talking an awful lot about her spiritual life. So after the engagement, I said, "Hey, Margot, what's up with that? I thought you were an atheist." She said, "Well, Michael, remember I worked for that AIDS services agency? This woman named Cassandra came and gave us an in-service. And I happened to mention to her that I don't believe in God." "Oh, yes, you do," she said. "You believe in grandmothers, don't you?" I thought that was so exquisitely beautiful. And that one sentence changed Margot's life. And I mean changed her life. Several years later, I bump into Cassandra at the cafeteria at UCLA. "Cassandra, hi, how are you?" I told her about Margot, the amazing impact she had had on her life as she had had on mine. Cassandra just scrunched up her face and looked a little befuddled. "You don't believe in grandmothers? That doesn't sound like anything I'd say. It doesn't even make sense." It did to Margot. And there are synchronicities that are beyond the momentary game changers. There are some that are so grand and intricate that they give us a glimpse into the mystical. I had such an experience a few years ago. Well over 30 years ago, during my dancing days, I was touring internationally with a particular musical artist who had three backup singers. One of those singers, Jenny, had a blind husband, I remember. I never met him, but I just remember being struck by that circumstance. What must it be like to be married to a blind man? And another of the singers, Sarah, I was particularly fond of her, and we had a nice friendship. As it is in life and show business, after the tour, we drifted apart, didn't see each other. 30 years later, I'm at the music center, I'm seeing a concert. I'm walking out of the men's room, and in walks a blind man. Somehow I knew this was Jenny's husband. I don't know how I knew. I offered to help him with the doors. He gratefully accepted. I offered to wait for him and help him get him back out to the lobby. "Oh, that would be great. How'd you like the concert?" I asked. "Oh, I loved it," he said. "Well, my wife's a singer, and I'm a musician myself." "Is your wife Jenny, by chance?" "Well, yes. How did you know?" "I don't know how I knew. Is she here?" "Yeah, she's out in the lobby." So I get him out to the lobby. I have a mini 30-year reunion with Jenny. And I say, "Hey, do you ever see Sarah anymore?" "All the time," she says. "Well, here's my number. Would you have her give me a call? I'd love to catch up." A week or so goes by, Sarah calls and says, "Michael, what are you doing these days?" "You're never going to believe it, Sarah. I'm a hospital chaplain." "Oh, my sister really needs a chaplain. She has cancer. She's on the 10th floor at UCLA." That was my floor. I had already introduced myself to her, and she turned me down for a visit. Now I had an entree to get in the room. "Hey, I'm Sarah's friend." How about that? Some coincidence, huh? It actually stretches the limits of my rational mind to write that off to coincidence. Paradoxically, it makes more sense to me that there is some organizing principle of the universe or power greater than I can comprehend that could explain so many disparate pieces falling together over the span of 30 years. At any rate, so many pieces of that puzzle falling together fills me with a state of awe and wonder and magic. The second land on my map of magic is the land of scale. So much about American culture in particular is about growth. Being, doing, having more, more, better, different, gotta get more, gotta do more. Even for those of us who would maybe choose to reject more consumerist notions of success, we want to do more for our families, for world peace, for justice, whatever it is. What I found in my own life and in the lives of the patients I've served, though, is the magic gets revealed not when we are enlarged, but when I am diminished, or when I disappear altogether. In the mid-1980s, I was ensnared in a pretty deep, debilitating depression that just went on for quite a while. And in the spring of 1985, I decided to take a trip by myself up to Yosemite to do some hiking for a few days, hoping to maybe find some inspiration and a sense of renewal. I can't put it strongly enough. The place gave me my life back. 3,000 feet of granite on the face of El Capitan, the majesty of Yosemite Falls bursting in the spring, those delicate dogwood blossoms opening to the sunlight, those astounding giant sequoias in the Mariposa Grove. Maybe it was a glimpse into the eternal, I don't know, but I know a key element of that was experiencing my smallness amid that grandeur. The experience was so profound, I've returned nearly every spring ever since as a kind of a ritual. But the key element is the element of scale. Well, a few years ago, I was flying home from somewhere, and I looked out the airplane window, and there was Half Dome down there. There was no announcement from the pilot, ladies and gentlemen, if you look outside the left side of the aircraft, you'll see Yosemite National Park. What's more, there was no stirring in my soul whatsoever to spy this seemingly inconsequential crack on the back of the Sierra Nevada. And that left me startlingly sad. Hey, does that mean that my healing was somehow synthetic or manufactured? That place had enough power to give me my life back, and from here it's nothing but a crack in the rock. Was that just some spiritual trompe-l'oeil, a trick of the eye? What if it was? Even if it was, I'll take it. And I would choose to move my life in a direction where I can be swallowed up into that kind of awe again and again, much the same way that someone might plunk down their hard-earned money to be knowingly fooled into a state of wonder by a magician like Doug Henning. I think that's some of the pull of chaplaincy to me, to be present for that kind of groundlessness and powerlessness, to be a witness to something as incomprehensibly huge as death. Life, on one hand, is kind of knowable. Death is another story. But the doorway of inspiration in this realm swings both ways, not just in the direction of from where I stand to the grand place, but from where I stand to even the smaller place. I can't tell you how many patients find meaning and significance in the teeniest details of life. Sometimes the more inconsequential and insignificant the detail, the clearer the looking glass is into the profound. Esther has a very aggressive colon cancer and is undergoing a very rigorous chemotherapy to hopefully shrink her tumors enough in order to have a surgery to resect her colon. She has a very long road ahead of her. One Monday morning in the clinic, I went to see her and she looked a mess. And she told me what a horrible weekend it had been the whole week, such pain, such fear. She said, I've been a crazy woman all week. And when I feel that kind of stress, I go into this hyperkinetic, hypervigilant cleaning and organizing mode. I must have hit every drawer, every cabinet, every closet in our house. I drove everyone crazy. I drove the dogs crazy. I drove the kids crazy. I drove my husband crazy like it was the end of the world. Part of me, of course, wanted to say, Esther, if you're still in the mood, I have got a garage. Said, I even made Frank get in a car with me and drive clear across town over to the Ralph supermarket by where I work to show him where they sell the pink lemonade that is our son Kyle's favorite. Just in case I'm not here to get it for him, they don't sell it at the pavilions by our house. We both laughed and cried a little bit at the nuttiness of that story, and yet I was so moved by the love in it. By her desire, of course, to control whatever she can into the future, that hell or high water, Kyle is going to have his pink lemonade. But also by Frank and his willingness to be such a good sport and get in that car and schlep across town. When I'm sure in his mind, babe, we got way bigger fish to fry here than this pink lemonade. I'm moved by the love, but also by the humanity. And by our capacity to find meaning in the teeniest details in life. A few years ago, I was served as the palliative care chaplain at UCLA, and one afternoon I was paged to come down to Marge's room. When I got down to the unit, Marge's son and daughter, Gary and Sue, were having that awful conversation with the doctor and the nurse out in the hallway. There's nothing more we can do. I gingerly approached this tearful huddle, and I introduced myself, and Gary just said, Michael, can you go in the room and just talk to my mom? But when I went into Marge's room, it was as if she were in a different TV show altogether. She was this light-hearted, breezy, sassy gal in her 70s. I sat down, we had the most wonderful conversation about her life and the wisdom she picked up along the way, and she shared a few jokes. About a half an hour into our conversation, in walk Gary and Sue, brave smiles on their face and big bloodshot puffy eyes. And they sat down and we had the most sacred four-way conversation about their lives and the reminiscences of their mom and having a few laughs. Suddenly Marge breaks out of her reverie and says, "Quick, Gary, son, what time is it?" "At 3 o'clock, Mom, why?" "Oprah's on." "Oh, are you a big Oprah fan?" I asked. "Oh yeah, Michael, I never miss Oprah." I said, "Well, Marge, would you like us to leave the room and so you can watch Oprah in private, or would you like to continue our conversation?" "Oh, gee, thanks, Michael. I would just love to watch Oprah." So we left. Not without a little judgment on my part, I must admit. I mean, hey, this might be the last conversation you have with your kids and you're going to want to watch a TV show. She died a few hours later. That would be the last conversation she would have with her kids. And when I can get my judgment and my agenda out of the way, I find that to be profoundly beautiful. That she could summon whatever life force she had to anchor herself back into normalcy, into reality as she knew it. That's what I do every day at 3. I watch Oprah. I don't think it's a stretch to call that a sacred ritual. And I'll bet Oprah herself would even be filled with wonder to hear that story. The third land on my map of magic is the land of vulnerability. So much in our culture would tell us to avoid vulnerability at all costs. Better wear your seatbelt, lock your door, get an alarm, buy some insurance. Don't ask for help, don't talk to strangers, don't go in that part of town at night, and by God, do not cry in public. What I have found, again, in my own life and the lives of my patient, magic gets revealed in the opposite direction when we move toward that vulnerability. And if cancer is anything at all, it is a doorway into the land of the vulnerable in so many levels, in so many dimensions. Like all of us so proud of our independence and self-reliance, countless patients tell me the struggle that it is to need the help that cancer demands. Needing it is one thing, accepting it is another. Vulnerability. I would say that vulnerability is at the very essence of the spiritual opportunity that the cancer journey offers. Hundreds of patients tell me about this outpouring of love when they get diagnosed, often from the unlikeliest of sources. The kind of love that heals, that restores them to a sense of interdependence and community. Louise is this high-power gal, a museum director, breast cancer, the kind of go-to person if you want to get something done. She was sharing with me about what happened at work when she finally had to come out as a cancer patient and admit she was going to have to pull back some. The craziest thing, Michael, people started coming to me with their problems. I'm the one with cancer, and here they're coming to me with their problems. And these are problems, I got to say, that would pale in comparison to cancer. But the thing is, Michael, it was a gift to me. It was a blessing. Cancer had robbed me of so much, disempowered me. And now I was given this opportunity to be of service in a whole other way and to create relationships in a way I'd never been permitted before. I call that a kind of magic. But as I say, needing help is one thing and accepting it is another. Ahmad was this very proud Lebanese man, a husband, a father, an engineer, relatively non-religious Muslim whose theology boiled down to the golden rule, whose journey through cancer had put his focus like a laser on kindness, of what a value that is, kindness and being of service. He had end-stage liver cancer. And the essence of his spiritual struggle was the pain and suffering he thought he was causing his family. He even asked me, "Michael, do you think it's selfish of me to get treatment, knowing what it's going to put my family through?" His wife and his son could only cry in astonishment to hear those words. In their view, doing any little thing they could for Ahmad, be it help him to the toilet in the middle of the night or rub some lotion on his feet or get him his meds, these were gifts, these were blessed opportunities to be able to do something, to be able to show him how much they loved him. Doesn't he know we would do everything possible just to keep him comfortable and keep him with us as long as possible? On the other side of that fence sat Ahmad, who thought there was still one way he could still be the father and protector of his family. He could plan his own funeral service. His family wouldn't even begin to start that conversation. So there, each of them sat with their own gift returned, unopened, on their lap. Just love trying to get out and express itself. My mother is a lung cancer survivor herself. 11 years ago this month, she was diagnosed and underwent chemotherapy and surgery to remove a lobe of her lung. On December 31st that year of 2001, my sister and I were hiking up in the mountains above Idlewild, and we were reflecting on that momentous year and what had been the highlight of the year for us. My sister got tearful and said, "I think the highlight of my year was taking care of Mom after her surgery and wiping her behind." It doesn't get any smaller or more intimate, or for most of us, probably any more horrifying, that lack of dignity and humility. And yet it was the highlight of my sister's year. The crazy places we find magic, huh? Like my mom, I would simply love to have answers to all the big questions in life. Why do we have to go through what we go through? Why do we have to lose everything we will love? Who wouldn't? But the more I think about it, I think Doug Henning was onto something, because I do know the blessings that are to be found there in the experience of wonder and magic. That's where all the goodies are. And so I would choose, I think, to give up my delusions that I really know anything at all, or that I'm smart enough to figure it out, just for the chance to experience more of that wonder, that magic, that love. After all, now I've even got a map to show me the way. So be it.